Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information, security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray, and you know what? We've got a real bread and butter InfoSec show for you this week. Adam will be along in this week's news segment to talk about the latest with those Intel AMT bugs, Tavis Ormandy's horror show Windows Defender bug, the Macron email dump, and more. In this week's feature interview, we speak with Adobe security engineer and OAuth 2 in action co-author Antonio Sanso about what companies like Google might be able to do to make their OAuth implementations a little safer for users, which, you know, might be something worth considering given an OAuth-based phishing attack worm thing was able to compromise something like a million Google accounts the other week. This week's show is brought to you by Thinkst Canary. Canary is, of course, the wonderful little hardware honeypot device Thinkst makes that you can plug into your network and it'll let you know when you have attackers on your LAN. It is very good stuff. Thinkst head of development, Marco Slaviero, joins the show this week to talk about the CIA's own vision of what Thinkst calls Canary tokens. That solution, of course, is called Scribbles. It was leaked by WikiLeaks. He's also going to talk a little about Thinkst's so-called bird guide. It is a document with a bunch of advice for those of you considering deploying honeypots. All of that is coming up later, but first off, the news with Adam Boileau. And Adam, last week we promised listeners that we would, you know, keep them abreast of further developments with this Intel AMT bug, and oh boy.
Yes, the details came out of the bug in question. Turned out to be one of the options that we speculated about, which was that it was an authentication bypass, in the web interface of this Intel AMT thing. Turns out, yep, sure enough, it is an auth bypass. If you can talk to it on the network, then you can log into it with an empty password.
Boom! Those of you,
I know, right? Yeah. Apparently, when it does the string comparison of the password you send, it uses the length of the password provided by the attacker to determine how many characters it should compare, and if your password is 0 bytes long, then, well, there's 0 bytes to compare, so therefore it totally matches.
It checks out.
The old among you will recall that MySQL had that bug in 1999, I think.
Didn't you find something similar in Supermicro? Was that
yeah,
you?
The Supermicro ones. I remotely shelled a Supermicro ILO by smacking enter angrily at the password prompt, thus sending an empty password and logging in much the same way. So yes, this is not a unique bug class, although it is completely rubbish.
You just owned it with rage, right? Like that works.
I did.
You got to think someone else has actually found it this way. Now, a bunch of listeners got in touch to actually let me know that some of the large integrators actually do use Intel AMT, like companies like HP. I'm not sure about EDS or, you know, but those types of companies apparently use this stuff. Obviously, they don't expose it to the internet. It's all via VPN, but still, oh boy.
Yeah, it certainly has the scope to be pretty bad. Although, I mean, the question is whether or, you know, this really does get exploited in the wild, just because it doesn't seem to be quite as common as you would first expect, other than in enterprise environments. And, you know, if you're in an enterprise environment in a position to talk to this service, you've already got so many other ways to own everything that, you know, this is probably not, it's probably a good way of doing it, but it's not the most convenient of the many you no doubt have available to you. But yeah, it's, in some respects, it's not quite as bad as it could have been. I know the Ars write-up, Dan Gooden's write-up on Ars, the title was "The Hijacking Flaw That Lurked in Intel Chips is Worse Than Anyone Thought," which actually is the opposite of what is true. It's not as bad as we thought. But
well, I think what he's getting at is like the impact might not be as high, but the stupidity level is you know, greater than we expected.
Well, I mean, I don't know that it's greater than I expected. That's the sort of rubbish bug you do get on embedded systems. But yeah, it's not, I mean, in terms of impact, it's just not quite as bad as we thought. And you have to have a version of the AMT that's within the last 2 or 3 years to have the kind of features that attackers would like. Some of the older ones are really not very featureful. Like you can power cycle the machine and kind of that's about it. It's not as bad, not as planet melty as it could be. Although there is actually a novel twist that showed up this
week.
Yeah,
I was just about to prompt you into discussing this. But yeah, the wireless angle, Adam.
Yeah, so Matthew Garrett has done a bunch of work, obviously, in this kind of embedded system space, and he's been following the AMT bug. He had a good write-up last week that we referred to a fair bit. He's done some more work on whether or not the AMT interface is available over the wireless network on devices which support that, and it turns out that yes, it is. If you have enabled AMT and you have turned on the wireless thing, the AMT subsystem-y bit will actually join wireless networks pre-boot and expose the service, which clearly seems bad. You have to tell it what wireless networks in advance, so it's not awful. But the second case is when you've got the Windows drivers installed, it will actually snarf packets off the wireless networks that your Windows has joined, which, you know, if you take your laptop to the, you know, airport frequent flyer lounge and sit on the open wireless network with your corporate machine, might actually be really, really bad. So, yeah, that's nice.
But that would assume that you had enabled this feature in the first place, or it had been enabled for you. And that was something that the listener pointed out, right, is it's fine when you're sitting behind a VPN in your corporate environment. But when you take that thing home, man, if you wind up on an open V4 address, you know, you're screwed, even if you've got host-based firewalling.
Well, exactly, yeah. I mean, the case of a laptop that's set up to connect to, you know, hotel or airport or whatever public wireless networks, you know, that attack class where an attacker can see the wireless network names, you know, via the kind of, you know, Karma sort of wireless attack where you can pretend to be any of those open wireless networks and then connect via AMT. Like, that's a very realistic attack scenario against a corporate fleet where people are mobile and do use public networks.
Well, and government as well, right? Like, government, certain summits, you know, discussing certain topics.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, you choose your location to suit your targets.
Well, look, moving on to, I mean, it's been a really interesting week for bugs, actually. And, you know, last week, I think it was late last week, Tavis Ormandy posted a Twitter saying, whoa, you know, he's found a shocker in Windows that affected default installations and was wormable, which led to a whole bunch of ambulances being dispatched everywhere. But Microsoft has patched it on as of Monday, right? And that patch is making its way through the internets. So, you know, good result in that respect, but the bug itself is a bad one.
Yeah, and you know when Tavis says this is bad, that it's going to be bad, and it absolutely delivered. This was a bug that he and another Google researcher, Natalie Slanovich, found. I don't know what they were doing when they found this bug, but it's a beautiful thing. So the Windows Defender, like Microsoft antivirus thing, like all antivirus engines, has a whole bunch of complexity. You got to parse a whole bunch of untrusted content. You got to do so very quickly. You got to do so in generally a privileged context because it has to work system wide and at a low level, you know, hooked into disk drivers, that kind of thing. Anyway, so they were looking at it, and it turns out that there is a JavaScript evaluation engine in the Microsoft AV product, and it will parse anything it sees go past on the network or on the disk or whatever that looks enough like JavaScript to see what's going on. And
Ruh-roh.
Surprise, surprise, there's bugs in JavaScript engines. Who knew? And especially when you're running this up in, you know, kernel space or wherever the hell it is, this is really, really bad. And they found a bug. They turned that into control of EIP, and yes, it's a beautiful thing.
Their proof of concept was like breaking all of the, you know, heaps of gateways in the path, right? When they were trying to report this thing. It's a legit horror show bug.
Yeah, it is, because any way that you can get the trigger for this bug in front of the parsing engine is good. And that can be as simple as, you know, getting it via IIS web server or posting it via email or, you know.
Yeah, Outlook Mail, right? It kind of reminds me, some years ago, there was a bug in Apple's Spotlight indexing service. So all you had to do was get a file onto the disk somehow, and when Spotlight came past to index it, it would parse it. You know, bad things would happen and then shells, right? So it's one of those sort of bugs, and they're some of my favorites.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of bug where you choose the attack service to match, a really unique capability of the bug. So, I mean, in search indexing or antivirus or like the Wireshark protocol dissectors, for example, you know, anything where, you know, you don't have to worry about layered security controls. And that's one of the beautiful things about this, you know, bugs in AV is they will unpack nested archives. So all of your network defenses that are looking for, you know, dumbly signatures on the wire aren't going to see something that's inside a zip, inside an arc, inside a, you know, an arg, whereas the antivirus engines are expected to parse that. And much the same with, you know, with Wireshark or, you know, where it's parsing nested traffic inside things. These are wonderful places to find bugs. And a bug like this is just, it's just a beautiful bug. A beautiful bug, beautiful research on behalf of the people at Google. And then, yeah, for Microsoft to turn around a patch for that so quickly. And interestingly, this patch, of course, gets rolled out as part of the, Windows Defender update mechanism independently of Windows Update.
Yeah, it's not a Windows Update patch, right? It's like internally fixed, and it's, you know, that's just happened. You don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, and that happened super quick. People were having those patches rolled out in a very, very fast over the weekend. So, you know, top response from Microsoft, really good quality, very rapid, which is great to see. And you know, that kind of, you know, really good research out of Google and really good response out of Microsoft, that's, you know, best case for this industry. And that's really nice to see. We don't get a lot of that. And it's really nice that on occasion we don't, as an industry, completely fail. So, yay.
Yeah, I mean, funny aspect to this was that people were giving Tavis an awful lot of because he tweeted, hey, you know, I found a bug in this. And, you know, I think when he's done the same with password managers, that's different because that sends a signal to people who might not necessarily know better that, hey, you shouldn't use a password manager. This doesn't send a signal saying, hey, don't use Windows. Do you know what I mean? So I kind of think it's a bit unfair that he was, you know, he had people sort of hassling him over this, don't you?
Yeah, I agree. I think the example of trying to use this as an example of, you know, disclosure being bad, like, is totally not legitimate. And no. I don't buy it even slightly. So, yes, I think that everyone who does not agree with that should piss off.
There is another interesting bug. This one has not been in the news, but this one is just really, really bad. And what's funny about it is I think the first time you and I ever spoke was something like 12 years ago, something like that, when I contacted you to speak to you about storage system security, right? This was for a feature I was doing for some magazine, and we spoke about it, and it's remarkably similar to the issues that you and I spoke about then 12 years ago.
Yeah, so this was a bug that came on my radar today. It got dropped a couple of days ago on the full disclosure list in Veritas Net Backup, which is a really widely deployed enterprise backup product. But essentially the TLDR is like remote pre-auth, remote code execution against every component of this solution. And it's the same bug that they fixed badly a year ago and is very similar bug to bugs they've had, you know, all through the years. But it's just, you know, a product that is in the position of a backup agent in a corporate, you know, an enterprise environment, having CVSS 10 bad remote code exec that's just trivial to exploit in the year 2017 AD is just so not acceptable. And in this case, right, if you run, I was going to say Symantec NetBackup, Symantec and Veritas apparently parted ways last year, but
they merged. They demerged. It happens, you know?
Yeah. But if you run this stuff, you really, really need to get on top of this particular set of bugs because there's, you know, there's proofs of concept of how to exploit this in the wild. And it's like as simple as if you can talk to the backup server, you can get A, it to execute code on your behalf, or B, have it ask any one of its other clients to execute code as root on your behalf, which means you pop a box in DMZ, you talk to the backup server, and you ask, I don't know, the PCI card processing zone box, which also shares the same backup. Maybe you'd like to exec some code, you know, send me a shell, maybe some credit card numbers. That would be great.
Yeah, I mean, it is a horror show one, right? And the Intel bug and this bug have one thing in common. And, you know, when you said it's not good enough, you're absolutely right, because too often, look, you get a really complicated bug or a really novel bug in something like Windows. Okay, fair enough. It happens, right? But when it's this stuff, like, you would think that a $10,000 security audit, you know, with by any consultant worth their salt, you throw them at this for a few days, they're going to find this.
Well, yeah, I agree. And especially when these products are so expensive as well. I mean, like, you know, enterprise software is not cheap. And for it to have not undergone, you know, basic security testing is just simply not good enough. And it's really not expensive, you know, relative to the kind of the value of the products and the value of the business and the value of the brand, you know, and yeah, it's just, it frustrates me when we see, especially security focused software and backups kind of in that area, in that it has a security boundary component. You share backups across security zones. That a security product really, really, management products really do need to be of a significantly higher bar than, you know, things that don't have hard security boundaries to enforce.
So there you go. If you're a Veritas customer, if you're using Veritas Backup, this is something that, yeah, you need to get on top of. Stat. Now, of course, the big news of last week was when 9 gigabytes of email belonging to various members of Macron's campaign team in France were dumped online just before the press blackout that would prevent French media from reporting on these things. You know, it was all leaked online by our you know, exactly who you'd expect. It looks like the Russians did it, Adam.
Yeah, we had some talk last week about there being campaigns run on the same infrastructure using the same techniques as APT-28 that hit Fancy Bear, that hit elements of the American government and elsewhere. And so, yeah, the fact that this then actually did result in data being dropped in an attempt to influence the election. And we actually saw also some testimony in the US that it was, according to the NSA, it was the Russians. So that's a, you know, another fairly strong finger to point. But yeah,
just back up there for a second, because I don't think this was really an attempt to sway the election. I think that they probably didn't really find much in there that was interesting. And I don't know, leaking it at the 11th hour was just a little bit of a, you know, they're trying to piss in the punch. They're not trying to swing the result, because nothing was going to swing that result. Do you know what I mean? Like, Macron was so far ahead. Like, I think this, I think this was just pissing in the punch.
Yeah, although we said that about Trump versus Clinton, you know, when that went the other way. Although that, it's kind of a more complicated situation. But yeah, I don't know. Like,
Macron got 65% of the vote. You know what I mean? And, you know, we've seen this really silly reporting now and, you know, a few tweets going viral because one of the Macron, you know, digital campaign strategists or whatever said that he was planting fake emails for WikiLeaks. Well, he didn't even say that, but that's what people interpreted. They said that they were responding to phishing emails, you know, with fake credentials and whatever. Now, look, there is a time, there are moments where that makes a lot of sense, right? You can actually give some fake credentials to someone and then watch which IPs try to use those credentials, and you can add them to a blacklist or do something more sophisticated that way. But based on the sort of tone of this guy's comments, I think he was just like, you know, trying to sound cool. Do you know what I mean? I don't think this was a really sophisticated reverse disinformation campaign. Do you know what I mean? So I think that that meme that's been going around is a bit silly.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. There's a very big difference in terms of, you know, preparedness and awareness from submitting bad creds to something that you know is a fish. Like, it happens all the time. Whenever we run a phishing campaign, you know, we get people saying rooteries to us in the login box when they realize it's a fish. There's a very big difference between that and like deliberately crafting fake documents and then making those available to the people that you have given credentials to, you know, via some mechanism, you know, via whatever document sharing or Google Docs, whatever you're getting phished by. Like, that's a whole nother level of preparedness and planning that I don't think rings true. And to jump from a report of, you know, oh, we entered some fake creds, you know, just to kind of wind them up or whatever, to we were crafting fake documents, that's a very big leap. And I don't know that the data and what people were saying supported that leap. And it's just kind of, and people who don't really understand the difference.
Yeah, and it takes a lot of foresight and a lot of very careful planning to do something like that. Do you know what I mean? And I'm not sure really what it gets you. Because even if you put in some fakes, they get reported as real, you deny them, people won't believe your denial. I mean, this isn't how disinformation works, you know? You can't just point to something and say, it's fake, because people will say, well, of course you're going to say that, you know? So yeah. I just that whole little thing that's bubbled up over the last few days, I don't believe it, and I don't think it'd do them much good even if they were doing that. But look, there is one really interesting aspect to all of this, which is the French Electoral Commission, essentially, put out a release, and I actually had to contact... I contacted a friend of mine, Nick Miller, who's Fairfax Media's Europe correspondent. So thanks, Nick, for actually helping me out on this. I contacted Nick to ask him for clarification because there were a lot of reports about how the French government was saying we will go after anyone who is distributing this stolen material online. You know, this is a crime. You cannot distribute it. And, you know, a lot of people were a bit confused about whether or not they were speaking about the French media or if they were speaking about individuals as well. And Nick was able to clarify for me that they were definitely speaking about individuals as well. They were threatening to go after individuals for spreading hacked emails on social media. That's the first time we've seen this in a sort of, you know, real, quote unquote, real country, you know, like not North Korea.
Yeah, no, that is an interesting development, and whether or not they are, you know, kind of successful in going that route, or whether it ends up being kind of more of a distraction and they let it, you know, they kind of let it slide. But yeah, the French laws around, you know, kind of electioneering that close to the and you know, publishing material about the elections that close to the elections do seem quite strict. And yeah, maybe they will. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, but what I found interesting about the statement from the Electoral Commission is it was couched more in terms of this is stolen material than this is to do with electoral law. So I don't think it was just the timing. And, you know, when the Sony hack happened, and a lot of people might have forgotten this, right? Sony was briefly considering, and I think they might have even gone to court once or twice, to try to get media to pull certain articles based on stolen material because it was stolen, and they were looking at all sorts of ways they could do that, including looking at something as funny as copyright, you know, because those emails are technically their copyright. It didn't go anywhere in the end, but I think we will start to see the tide turning and authorities saying, hey, look, if this is stolen material, you can't just go sending it around, which I don't know. I mean, kind of sounds fair enough. I mean, it shouldn't mean that you can't report on it, but, you know, disseminating stolen documents does seem like it's something that, hey, maybe should be illegal if it's not provably in the public interest.
Yeah, it's certainly an argument that we've seen play out in a number of places where, you know, there's been reporting or books or media based on stolen material. But yeah, the sort of the aspect of individuals doing it, you know, without any of the kind of public interest balance that you would get in the case of journalists or media. Yeah, it's, you know, clearly that now that hacking and this kind of leaking and disinformation are such, you know, important parts of you know, every aspect of endeavor these days, it seems, maybe we will see, you know, sort of a societal shift in terms of what the acceptable use of that kind of stolen material is. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. And I mean, you know, it's fraught, right? Because what I just described, like, oh, you know, criminalizing passing around stolen documents, you know, what if they are in the public interest? Who decides what the public interest is? On and on and on we go. But certainly the French took a stand on that. So yeah, that's interesting. And, you know, just one to keep an eye on over the next few years. Gizmodo has done this. They've given the Trump administration a free security audit, essentially. They basically sent a bunch of more or less phishing emails to various Trump administration figures to see if they would click on them or reply to them. And they did get a bunch of clicks, and they even got a reply from James Comey, who we'll talk about in a bit. They got a reply from James Comey saying he didn't want to click without care. You know, what is this document you've sort of sent me? It was like a Google, Google sign-in page or whatever. So interesting, right? That, you know, and it just proves what I think most listeners to this show know, which is that, you know, phishing links work.
Yeah, I think if anything, it was kind of surprising that the response rate was so low. They got, what, 50% click-through?
But that lines up exactly with the Verizon data breach investigation report from a couple of years ago. That was their 50% on first attempt, and then you could get it up to 90% by, you know, following up on the...
Some follow-up.
Yeah, exactly, yeah, right? So 50% for first attempt. I mean, hey, nicely done, Verizon. Your data is accurate.
Yeah, there's actually a lot of hand wringing in the comments about whether Gizmodo had gotten legal advice in advance of doing this, like whether sending people phishing emails was in fact illegal. And there's a lot of you know, amateur legalities going on. But yeah, this kind of, you know,
well, given the page that the, you know, clicker was directed to didn't actually capture login information, I'm pretty sure they're in the clear.
I would certainly hope so. Every step of the way, it actually did have a little, like, this is written by Gizmodo, this is not real, little footer thing for people to look at. But yeah, it's, I don't know, this is quite cool, actually. I like this. It's a good concept. Go ahead and fish some politicians, fish some people. You know, don't go up to the line of actually fishing them and see what happens. Yeah, why not? That seems like legit investigative journalism to me.
Well, I don't know. It's legit investigative trolling or something. I don't know. I don't quite know if it qualifies as investigative journalism. Now, Adam, turning our attention to some incident responders news, James Comey, incident responder in chief, has been fired by Donald Trump, you know, and of course they're saying it's because he was mean to Hillary Clinton over emails, which is
doesn't make any sense.
I don't know, man. I think backwards. If people believe this bullshit, they kind of deserve him as a president personally, but
that's how we ended up where we are, clearly.
Yeah. So, you know, James Comey has been fired, just as, you know, you get the sense that the Russia story just is not going away. And it's just so amazing that I remember when we first seriously discussed this, it was July last year after the first CrowdStrike report. And, you know, to be now sitting here talking about how Donald Trump, President Donald Trump, has just fired the FBI director who's in the middle of investigating Russia hacks. It's just, what a world.
What a world. Yeah, it is. And it's you know, it's frustrating and depressing and makes you angry. And it's just the whole thing is entirely ridiculous. It does seem, though, that maybe this is a step that... I don't know. I mean, Trump's done so many ridiculous things. Maybe it isn't a step too far. I don't know. But I mean, all the Americans I know really do seem to be, you know, somewhat concerned by this.
Yeah, but you're in your lefty latte sipping, organic wool wearing freaking lefty bubble, aren't you, beardy
my
guy?
My latte bubble, yes. This is true. I am in my beardy latte bubble. I have latte stuck in my beard this very second. This is what happens. It smells of patchouli and lattes and, yeah.
But there you go, man. There you go. Fallout from those hacks. Still continuing, and it's going to be real interesting to see what happens over the next few weeks, because there's rumors of grand jury investigations and all sorts of shit. So yay, America. Thanks for making politics fun again, because you've certainly done that. We've got a stats story here. Google last December launched a thing called OSS Fuzz, which was for fuzzing open source applications. And apparently it's hit 1,000 bugs. They found 1,000 open source bugs.
Yeah, no, this is a really good program, you know, providing Google engineering time and compute resource to run fuzzing on open source software in the public interest is a really honorable cause. And the fact that they're killing bugs in all sorts of really important things. And that's, if you look at the list of some of the bugs they're finding, There's a bunch, for example, in the libpcre, the Perl compatible regular expressions library, which is used everywhere and parses data from everywhere. Like, really good example of a bug that crosses security layers. Similarly, bugs of Wireshark, you know, they're focusing on smart things, which is really good and good for you know, the ecosystem as a whole. They also have a program where if you're an open source project, they actually have a bounty to integrate fuzzing into your, you know, kind of development life cycle, as, you know, so that you've got regular fuzz testing before you release, which is a really good thing, and they're paying real money for that to happen. So yeah, it's a great program. If you're an open source developer or a maintainer, certainly go and have a look and see if you meet the criteria to get some money from them to integrate fuzzing into your workflow.
Yay, Google, you get a biscuit. That's real nice, that they are supporting these types of programs and, yeah, putting some meaningful cash into them. But Adam, that's actually it for the week's news. Not a huge week for news, funnily enough, just a few high-impact stories. And, you know, I think everyone in the United States is too busy dealing with, you know, Comeygate to actually worry about posting many InfoSec yarns at the moment. But it's been a pleasure, mate, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Sure, Pat, you certainly will. Talk to you then.
That was Adam Bialow there with a look at the week's security news. And I just want to do some housekeeping now. Firstly, I keep forgetting to mention this, but Gruk has set up a Patreon. So if you enjoy his tweets and Medium blog posts as much as I do, you can support him in doing that. There is a link to his Patreon page in this week's show notes, but it's just, you know, patreon.com/Gruk, G-R-U-G-Q. As for things on the risky business side, we've almost sold out of those soapbox specials. We have one left running in August. But yeah, we do still have pretty good availability in Snake Oilers. That's our podcast where you get 10 minutes to pitch the risky business audience on your product. We had 4 vendors participate in the first one, and they're all absolutely stoked with the response. So basically, yeah, if your product is good, doing an episode of Snake Oilers will mean that you'll sell quite a lot of it, as it turns out. So if you're interested in doing that, please contact Risky Biz commercial manager Tiran Ferrier on sales@risky.biz. Okay, moving on to this week's feature interview now with Antonio Sanso. And yeah, as we spoke about on last week's show, a nasty little OAuth phishing attack worm thing went around the other week, and basically a user would receive an email that looked like an invitation to view a document on Google Docs. The user would click through and they'd then be presented with a page, which was, you know, an OAuth consent page, which would ask them to authorize something called, wait for it, Google Docs. Now, you look at that Google consent screen, the OAuth consent screen, and you'd be completely forgiven for thinking this actually was Google asking for account permissions. So the whole campaign, you know, wound up very, very convincing. So convincing, in fact, that it hosed something like a million accounts very, very quickly. Now, it struck me as odd, actually, that we've spent all of this time convincing people to use two-factor authentication and get smart when it comes to phishing, but then we serve them up a UI that allows them to hand out OAuth tokens to any rando who wants one with a single click. And yes, OAuth phishing is indeed the new black. Some of the Russian APT crews have moved to these sort of techniques. I'm not saying these techniques are new, just that they're becoming very popular and website operators really, really need to start thinking about how to best address this. To talk about this, I got in contact with Antonio Sanso after a few people recommended him. He's an Italian security engineer who works for Adobe in Switzerland, but he's also the co-author of OAuth 2 in Action and a part-time bug hunter. He joined me via Skype to talk about that Google Docs phishing attack and what can be done about similar attempts in future. Here he is.
Anyone that creates an OAuth application, it can put its own term of use link, can put any logo. So what the attacker did, he put a Google logo rather than put any other logo. He put a description of his business with a link and put Google link. So this is just how any OAuth implementation works. How can this improve? In my opinion, there is only one way to improve it. The UI of the content screen should look at and display the redirect URI, that is basically where the access token on or the authorization code is sent after the authorization.
So you think maybe the UI should tell people where they're about to send all of their user data? I think that's a pretty good idea exactly. Too, you know, right?
I don't think there's any other way. I mean, I think the only way to fix it is any UI or our content screen UI should say, hey, after you authorize this, your token is sent to this URL. I don't think there's any other way because all the other things are legit.
Do you think it's sensible, though, that Google allows just any app developer to grab OAuth tokens for Google accounts? Because I would have thought when the stakes are so high, when we're dealing with things like, you know, hacked inboxes, you know, international intrigue and espionage. You'd think maybe the default would be to only allow, you know, say the top 20 apps that I'm guessing 99% of people would use, you know, the obscure ones, maybe 20, 30 users. Maybe you want to really make the users jump through a few hoops before they can enable those.
I think this is fine. I mean, unless we have to ditch all out and SAML, otherwise it's just fine. I mean, this is, OAuth is an access delegation protocol. It is implemented just how it is designed. So you have the scope, a concept of scope, as everyone knows. So the scope can be Gmail, can be Google Docs, can be all the Google services. And for GitHub, it's repository or the list of your contacts and so on. So if you want to implement OAuth and like any access delegation protocol or any single sign-on system, this is just how it works. So I don't see any exception on it.
Mm. Well, and the other thing that I thought about too, right, is particularly when it comes to applications, right, applications that are designed to interact with popular services, you never know which ones are going to become wildly popular, right? That's why we like to have as open an ecosystem as possible, right? Because you never know when someone's crazy app idea turns into the must-have plugin for Gmail. You know, they might, you know, just make it heaps better and then they get acquired for gazillions of dollars down the track, right? So there's that as well.
Yeah, exactly. The point of this exploit, as I call exploiting, really, it's really hard for me to call this exploit.
Yeah.
At the end, people warned about this in 2012 through the ITF mailing list that they were already predicting this coming. Someone wrote on the ITF mailing list 5 years ago saying, hey, this is going to happen. Indeed, it just happened now, but it could happen 3 years ago, 2 years ago. But so this for me, when I read about it, I was like surprised to people call this like an exploit because I can hardly say this is an exploit.
Look, I want to talk a little more generally as well about OAuth, because it seems like OAuth implementations have gradually been improving, but they're still not 100%, right? So it seems like OAuth is one of those things that was fiddly and not well understood, which led to disastrous implementations. Now it's still fiddly, but people have kind of... You know, it's like the lion and they know how to, you know, use the whip and the wooden chair to sort of tame it a little bit and get it to work. Are you still seeing awful implementations out there or has it got substantially better?
It got substantially better, at least for big players. So I kind of like am a part-time bug hunter, and up to 3, 4, 5 years ago, OAuth was a gold mine for bug hunters. So it was so easy to find an issue in any implementation of OAuth, Facebook, GitHub, many, like was extremely easy to find issues on the implementation of those big players or OAuth implementation.
And what sort of mistakes did they generally make? Just logic bugs? Because that seemed to be what was tripping people up for a while.
There are basically two dangerous zones on OAuth implementations. One is the worst one by far, is the validation of the redirect URI. This was one of the most exploited. So basically, when an application registers a redirect URI, let's say, I don't know, example.com/path, and this is the register redirect URI, and then there is a redirect URI that is passed through a URL through the OAuth dance. There are different validation logic that OAuth server use. For example, the best one by far is the one that has Google. So basically, they accept only the identical string. If you register example.com/path, they only accept this, but then it comes to other implementations like Facebook or GitHub or Microsoft. So they accept anything that comes after path. For example, example.com/path/foo/bar, for them is fine. And it's still okay. But the point is, like, people found a lot of exception to this rule. So for example, they found path traversal, so they could go up to the hierarchy, ./.. go up and down again.
So you could ././ your way up and then replace the domain and have tokens being sent to completely different URLs and happy days.
Maybe not the domain yet, but they replaced the path, the subpath. But then they had people implementing as well subdomain. So if you register example.com, you could go, for example, to attacker.example.com, and it was actually a domain that was accepted by this regular expression on the server. But probably the best validation rule that it happened that I found against PayPal. So they had the kind of validation rule that was like, if the redirect URI starts with localhost, that's a valid redirect URI.
Oh,
so
God.
What I've done, I have a domain that is like intothesymmetry.com. I register localhost dot, so I added the DNS entry on my website. So I added localhost dot interested into the symmetry.com, and I got all the PayPal access token. So these are the kind of implementation mistakes that happens during the year. Then other common pain points are cross-site request forgery. So basically, the spec says to use a state parameter on the OAuth lens to avoid cross-site request forgery, and it's something really, really common. Then we had native apps. Basically, when the OAuth spec was designed, I think they clearly had a huge gap on how to do OAuth on native apps. Yeah, at the beginning, people were used to use WebViews on mobile apps, and WebViews is, whoever is into security knows that WebViews are absolutely a no-go for mobile applications. The security of WebViews is really poor compared to the browser shipped with a mobile device. This specification was started in 2010, when the mobile market was not as high as when the specification ended. Because when they started it, it basically was not so important mobile in 2010. But when it ended, mobile was really something that was mainstream. Now, the majority of the traffic worldwide happens in a mobile device, not in the computer. So basically, when OAuth was out, people that were implemented OAuth application, they didn't have a way that was written the spec how to implement OAuth. And this brought to a lot of issues. So people were doing really weird mistakes there. And yeah, some of those were exploited badly.
In addition to exposing the sort of redirect URI, right, to the user,
right,
what can these companies do in addition just to showing the final URL, you know, what you're authorizing? What can they do as well?
I don't think they can do much. I mean, you know, I follow this really closely, this story. And as well, I was really looking at other experts in Twitter. And I don't think that there is really a lot they can do, honestly. I mean, I might be wrong here, but I mean, unless restricting who can create application, and this is, I don't think that they can happen. I mean, I don't see people going that direction.
Well, I mean, that would be more like a, you know, sort of like a Apple App Store model, I guess. You know, maybe you could get people to apply for some sort of developer key and do some vetting. But then you're back to the whole frickin' CA problem, right? And the verifying trust and organizational validation and all of that crap that we've failed at everywhere else, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, unless they go that model, but then it's not a guarantee. Then you have a kind of, as you said, there is the CA problem where there is Google or in this case, it's Apple that is the only judge of whatever is good or not. It is always arguable. Then you have cases like, okay, I'm good. Then I turn to evil. And then what's happening? We are back to square one, right?
So or you get owned, right? Because, I mean, we saw a whole bunch of pretty high-profile Twitter users recently sending out some Nazi spam via their accounts because they had authorized some sort of stats app or something and then forgotten about it.
Yeah.
Those guys, I think, you know, more or less went out of business. Their servers fell out of update. Someone owned them. And, hey, look at all these Twitter accounts, right? I mean, that's going to be a thing we're going to see more of, yeah? You'd think.
The really good things to note there is that Twitter is still is using OAuth 1. So it's as if these things continues. It's not only about OAuth 2. Twitter never migrate to OAuth 2.
Basically. Is that a mistake? I mean, is OAuth 2 worth doing?
So they were happy. I mean, the point is like, I don't know any other company that stays to OAuth 1 apart Twitter. Big one, they all migrate to OAuth 2. Probably they have a really good infrastructure and a really good implementation of OAuth 1, and they just stayed with it. The point, there are a lot of critique of OAuth 2, and probably the weakest point of OAuth 2, in my opinion, is that it's a crypto-less specification. So it relies solely on TLS. Different in that than OAuth 1 has more, has some crypto inside. So basically, OAuth 2 has this concept of bearer token, and whoever obtained this access token has the same power than the legitimate owner of the token.
Mm.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot of trust to put in TLS, right? You know? It is.
Right. It is. And OAuth 1 just doesn't work like this. OAuth 1, you need some additional knowledge in order to have the trust.
I just think it's funny, right, that like companies like Google if you try to log in from a funny machine or a funny location or something, it's like, whoa, no, you got a two-factor and answer 50 questions and, you know, about your behavior. Yeah. But you want to give an OAuth token to some rando on the internet and they're just like, yep, no worries, click here. No warnings, no nothing, right? Like, it's just treated so differently. That's the thing that blows my mind.
Exactly. But this is a matter of fact at the moment. And I think in this case, we can improve. So here, I think there is room of improvement. So again, we already talked about this this UI problem, but here I think there is this room for improvements. But at least one thing I have to specify. After that, Google found the problem. At least all the good of OAuth came along. I mean, they could immediately
remove. Yeah, no, man, they smashed that thing on its head real quick, right? So that was good. In fact, we've had two good wins in the last week. We've seen Google respond really well to that. Well, that was last week. And then this week we've seen Microsoft respond in record time to Tavis Ormandy's horror show, Microsoft, Defender AV bug. That's pretty cool. But Antonio Sanso, thank you very much for joining us to have a bit of a chat about this. It's great to get your expert opinion on these matters. And I hope to speak to you again in the future.
Thanks a lot, Patrick.
That was Antonio Sanso there with a chat about OAuth. Big thanks to him for that. And yeah, you can two-factor your users up to the eyeballs, but if you're allowing single-click OAuth for full account takeover, maybe not so good. Okay, it's time for this week's sponsor interview now, and this week's sponsor is Thinxt Canary. Thinxt Canary are actually our biggest supporter for 2017, so thanks to them for that. Thinxt makes a really clever little thing called a canary, which is basically a little hardware honeypot you can plug into your network. They're really, really well designed, really easy to set up, and something you really should be getting familiar with. Anyway, Thinxt also operates canarytokens.org. That's a free website where you can set up all sorts of little canary tokens to seed around your network, whether that's a Word document that'll do some funky DRM checking in the background to let you know if it's popping up outside your organization trying to get, DRM authorization from a bogus key server you've set up or an authorization server you've set up. Or it could be a Windows folder or an email address or even a DNS token. It's very clever stuff. The whole idea is you sprinkle these tokens about, and if someone opens up one of those documents or visits one of these, canary domains or one of these folders, you have a problem. So it's kind of similar. It's actually more advanced, but similar to what the CIA was doing with its so-called Scribbles watermarking software that was leaked by WikiLeaks. So Marco Slaviero of Thinxt joined the show this week to talk about Scribbles, Canary Tokens, and the Honeypot Deployment Guide Thinxt recently published. We started off by talking about how Scribbles used a very old trick to track documents. They embedded a tiny little GIF in them. Here's Marco.
Mailing list software has been doing that since the 90s for tracking people opening mails and so on. But the thing there is, kind of one of the differences between what happened in the 90s has been making this really easy to use. And there's always this big jump between the proof of concept and actually making something repeatable and sort of low friction. And so what CIA did with Scribbles is they had this the C# tool that you can sort of run it across a directory of Office files, and it'll insert, you're sort of provided with parameters on the website that will host your sort of beacon receiving script, and it will insert custom URLs for each of the documents and sort of write it out to a log file so that it can come back and see which beacon mapped to which file.
So basically what you're saying is like 0 points for originality, but 10 out of 10 on implementation when you can just run a script on all of your file servers and, put beacons in everything. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, so I mean, like that's exactly the point, right? Is it's not a question of a new technique, but it is a question of making this thing really easy to use. And sort of they use this, or they specifically talk in the documentation about using this tool for, they sort of use end users in quote as the people who are going to open these documents, which I thought was a nice touch.
End users, yeah, that's nice. Sergey and, Vitaly.
Yeah. It specifically seems to be targeted at seeding these documents for foreign or for people who are not within the CIA. But what Scribbles doesn't touch on is how you build the other side of this, the equation here, which is the websites and domains and all of that, which receive the beacons and what that sort of receiving beacon actually looks like. And it could be just a static file hosted somewhere, but it doesn't. They don't sort of touch on whether that server-side component is also doing additional alerting for you, which you would assume it would have to do, but they don't really touch on any of that.
So we got the client-side goodies, not the server-side stuff.
Yep. Yeah.
So
that's sort of where Scribbles is at. One of the things that I thought was kind of interesting is that Scribbles makes use of this open-source zip file reader. So basically, they've taken a zip file processing library for C# from GitHub, and that's embedded in that. But the code's from 2010 now, sort of that's 7-year-old code. And it's kind of curious that, you know, they're using this open source code in their tool, which I suspect it's compliant with the license. But it did raise the question for me whether they're up to date with their Black Duck software subscription for tracking vulnerabilities and open source components in their internal tools. But yeah, this thing got released and now people are poring over it.
One thing is, though, you know, people have been sort of poo-pooing this and saying, oh yeah, as if spies would make these sort of mistakes, but spies would totally make these sort of mistakes. Do you know what I mean? Like these sort of documents, once they're obtained, they tend to get passed around. Maybe not everyone has good OPSEC. Maybe you forget to sanitize the document. Would that happen if you exported this to a PDF? Would it actually export the URL grabbing bit with it?
So exporting to PDF doesn't give you a PDF file that beacons. You won't get the same behavior. And this is one of the distinctions between what Scribbles does and the canarytokens.org site does. So canarytokens.org is obviously the free tool that we've got. And there we've got the ability to create a PDF with a token that would reach out. One of the distinctions there being that that PDF file will trigger its token even if you disable network connections in the PDF. So typically what happens in a PDF is when you open it up, if it tries to make a network connection, you get a little pop-up first that says, do you want to allow the connection or not? And the PDF that we build on canarytokens.org has already made the network connection at the time the pop-up occurs. So you get notified, but that there was an attempt. And even if you disallow the attempt, you've already, or the token's already been triggered. But the Scribbles tool doesn't support PDF at all, is the short answer.
I can imagine that they would have got plenty of hits on their Scribbles beacons, right? Which is kind of depressing that even signals intelligence agencies from some countries might, you know, screw up to the point where they're beaconing out, or, you know, their end users are beaconing out.
For sure. I mean, like, one of the reasons that we really like tokens is that, you know, we know of privacy activists who rely on canarytokens.org and have got hits from, as you say, some of the people in the intelligence community. So the idea that because they're intelligence, they don't get tripped up by this sort of technique isn't the case. Like, we've got
Are you saying that intelligence services have stolen documents from privacy activists and beaconed them?
That's our understanding.
Do you care to name those intelligence agencies?
I do not. No comment, I think, is the safe way to respond to that.
Yes, right. Okay, well, that's interesting. That's one, maybe a chat over a beer, Marco.
Sure. You're by.
Now, look, you've just launched a bunch of new stuff when it comes to Canary Tokens, right? I'm imagining there's a few CIA people listening. What should they be including in their version 2?
So the update that we've got on the site at this point is mostly in terms of simplifying the process and improving the UI. And then behind the scenes, we've also got examples of code which on our Canary product, in which we can insert Canary tokens into your own documents, your own Word documents, and so on. But the updated canarytokens.org free tool is certainly a lot easier to use at this point. So if some of the listeners had used the previous site, they may remember it was somewhat confusing. This one is now, it's been through the UX guidelines internally at Thinxt, which mostly consists of Harun and Nick throwing stuff at us when it doesn't look pretty. And they've now responded and it's got their okay. So
basically, just it's the same stuff, but it's more user friendly. Are you going to be introducing, do you think, server side tools along the lines of what the CIA did with Scribbles? Because that sounds like a great way to make Canary tokens. You know, once you've automated it, it seems like it'd be a lot more useful.
It's not something we've given explicit thought to basically would need to give it a little bit more, I guess, a bit more thought. At this point, we don't have an actual plan to duplicate it. I mean, the CIA has now had theirs published, so I guess you could go borrow their code in the interim.
Yeah, well, I was wondering if you guys were, you know, just saying, oh, we could probably re-implement this a bit more efficiently, a bit better, you know, add a few features, and there you go.
Yeah, so I think the one feature that we'll crib from them is expanding to Excel and PowerPoint files,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, not a bad idea.
That seems an obvious. That seems like an obvious one. The one thing though that I will say about Scribbles is, you know, they specifically focus on HTTP as their sort of beacon protocol, and Canary Tokens also uses DNS, which gets out of a few more networks that you know, aren't directly connected, but do have a sort of an indirect path via DNS resolvers. So we often default to DNS as our beacon protocol over HTTP.
Yeah, it makes sense. It makes sense. Now, look, another thing you've been working on is, you know, obviously Thinxt is best known for making the Canary honeypot, which is a great little device. You know, you stick it on the inside of your network, and when someone starts, you know, trying to log into it or grabbing documents off it or whatever, you know, that's a fairly clear indicator of lateral movement. So it's proving to be a very popular product. But, you know, there wasn't really much in the way of, you know, guiding philosophy around how to best deploy honeypots within a LAN. And you've actually written a guide now called the Bird Guide, right?
Yeah, that's right. So we recently published our guide to birding.
Birding, and wow, nice.
I'm going to stretch that metaphor as far as we
yeah,
can.
Yeah, no, I dig it. I can dig it. That's marketing speak that I can live with, birding.
Better than deception.
Mm-hmm, thank you. Yeah, it is.
So the basic thing there is that, like, in its default setup, a canary, you could configure it in actually a couple of thousand ways if you sort of put all the combinations together. And that sort of gives people a lot of options, but sometimes you have the tyranny of choice. And so what we want to do is help people identify some common scenarios where they can get up and running with something that matters to them. So, you know, it's one thing to say, you know, get a few canaries, sprinkle them around your network, but then the question is going to come up, which is, well, actually, which profiles must I select? And
yeah,
and
do I want it to look like a PlayStation, a Switch, or a Samba file server, right?
Yeah, for sure. And so pretty much our guide to birding, like, it's not a long document, so I'd recommend checking it out. We just advise on sort of some common scenarios or some common thinking for how you would go about, at least in the very first stages of deploying even honeypot. So it's not specific. I mean, obviously, we reference Canary in there, but if you want to take another honeypot and sort of use that, some of the thinking will still apply there. So it might seem a bit obvious with some of the things that we've got in the guide, but the thinking here is that customers who are new to the ideas of honeypots haven't spent time thinking about the stuff before. And so this gives them a nudge in the right direction and helps them to sort of plan out their first deployments of honeypots. And those honeypots don't have to be canary honeypots, but the examples that we use are canaries. And so one of the things that we think about when we deploy honeypots are the idea of spawn sites. So where are attackers likely to appear in your network? And with sort of a little bit of thinking, you'll quickly get to, if you've got an internal network, you may have a DMZ, attackers are going to target the services in your DMZ. Dropping a canary in there makes sense. If you've got a VoIP network, that could be a target for attackers if you rely on it heavily. Throw a canary in there. But it doesn't just have to be about the canaries themselves. So, I mean, with Canary tokens on the Canary product, we support throwing tokens on your S3 buckets. And so if you heavily rely on Amazon and its services, then a spawn point for an attacker would be S3. Throw some canary or some detection mechanism on your S3 buckets. Closely related to that is the idea of what we call crown jewels, and that's effectively the thing that matters most to your organization. So if you are a mining house, then your GIS or prospecting data would be the thing that you really care about. An insurance company may have a risk system that they really want to look after, or you know, an investment firm may have an analysis, and their analysis and research are the things that really matter to them. And so another quick sort of honeypot or canary technique would be to take those sorts of crown jewels, which are generally data related, and set up a storage canary with names that point to that sort of data, and you can set up fake files on it. So on the canary side, you can either have a NAS or you can deploy a Windows file share, and then you drop files related to that data that look juicy, and then you just wait for attackers to come looking for that. And so that's sort of another sort of quick way to get up and running with your canary birds. So the bird guide contains those sorts of things, and then we also touch on routers, common server profiles, custom intranets, how to find the birds, SCADA birds, custom modules, and some of the trivial extensions. So I think it's an easy read, and I think it's worthwhile checking out.
We will, of course, be including a link to your bird guide in this week's show notes, so people can go and check that out, and I'd recommend that they do. Marco Slaviero, thank you very much for joining us on the show, and again, thanks for your continued support of the Risky Business Podcast.
Thanks, Patrick. Appreciate your time.
That was Marco Slaviero there. Do check out this week's show notes for a link to canarytokens.org and also to the Thinxt Bird Guide. Big thanks to Thinxt Canary for sponsoring this week's show. And you know what? That is it for this week's podcast. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.